Hello, 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 and welcome to this week's episode of the Imaginary Movie Podcast, a podcast where we delve into every single movie made for 15-year-old girls in the 1990s. My name's David, and Sam, so totally, and some welcome. Words we cannot say on the podcast.
It's a 90s movie.
We were saying in 1995.
We are throwing around words that we could only dream of. No, we don't want to say these words. These are not good words to be saying. And
I want to put a pin in terminology because I want to very soon circle back to that. But this week, for a bit of change of pace, we decided we've been doing a lot of man movies lately.
White guy movies.
A lot of testosterone-y, muscly, high octane. I can't even remember any of them, but a lot of man movies, a lot of white guy movies. So we decided we're going to watch a movie directed by a woman. That's right, a woman. And we settled on, somehow, Clueless from 1995.
Clueless, yeah. We had been, I think it's kind of inadvertent because, hey, check your privilege. We are idiot white guys of the podcast, obviously. So we get drawn into the movies that we have been conditioned by the patriarchal society we exist in to want to watch. So let's... you know, change it up. Let's do something and let's... Oh, how do we attract Dave to this proposition? Known misogynist who hates any movies made by women. And so...
Especially movies directed at teens. I hate teen movies.
You're a teen-hating misogynist.
Teen movies starring women. I haven't literally suggested we watch a half dozen of those kinds of movies.
So it's a 90s movie. Check! It's a... teen coming of age comedy, check, and it's set in high school. What more could Dave possibly want? And I delivered it to him. Final check. It's streaming on Paramount Plus. Fantastic. So everything was achieved.
Before. Just to be clear, in case my loser credentials are in any doubt, I've seen this movie multiple times. This is really again, like, there's just something about coming of age comedies that just appeal to me.
You're in that Arrested Development, you know, reverted back to a childhood.
That's right. I'm a single man in my 30s and I live with my mother. I'm a stereotype.
That's not where I was going. I have the complete respect.
Yeah, I get it, Sam. All right. I've got a wife. I've got kids. I've got a high paying job. You're a fucking loser. It's all subtext. I understand. It's fine.
I mean, it's absolutely not subtext because it's not even the overt. There's nowhere near where I was going with that, Dave.
It's all relative, Sam, because I spent 4.5 hours watching The Office this afternoon. So, you know, give and take.
And what's really valuable in life? Let me tell you, listener, that's it right there. Clueless. I had not seen this, so stamp that loser brand on me immediately. And I've not seen this.
We've done another movie from 1995. We did Hackers a few weeks ago.
We did.
A lot in common with this movie and also very, very, very different.
Stupid man movie. Like, that's where we're... It's kind of this, a bit more...
Yeah, that's
kind
spectrum. Of... That movie is the opposite end of the spectrum to this movie. And we'll maybe talk about that again as we go through. But 1995 is kind of like this funny blank spot where these movies... maybe didn't start to come on British television until we weren't really watching it.
You know,
this is 1995. It's that blank spot of we weren't going to the cinema. We weren't seeking out these movies because they were a little bit older. And we didn't happen to see them when we were kids because we were too young. So this is kind of like, I didn't see this movie until I was a grown adult, which still makes it sometime in the last 15 years. But still...
And
Hackers
my,
was the same as well.
You've mentioned already, but my wife had I'd said this hundreds of times and was like giving me trivia as we were watching it and knew all the lines. Like, so I think it's definitely it's because of that toxic masculinity once again strikes us down and now has become more powerful than they could possibly imagine. And I think it's like really in that vein of, oh, I'm not watching a girl movie. That's a movie for girls. Like... Which I hope that modern teenage boys are less, you know, susceptible to. I doubt it because, boy oh boy, there are now multiple ways for teenage boys to be fucked up by the patriarchy. But you know what? this is the type of movie that if you just, as 14-year-old me, put my barriers down, like, it's great fun. It's so fun. It's cute. It's, like, sexy. Like, the whole thing, this is exactly what you want from this type of, like, teen romp, isn't it? You know, this is up there with the best of them for me in terms of just pure enjoyment, just to focus on making the viewer just have a great time almost all the way through.
Absolutely, I agree entirely. Let's talk about the terminology in this movie a little bit.
Okay.
Because some of it's recognisable, obviously. Alicia Silverstone's the star, plays Cher, and she spends, obviously, most of the movie talking at us, and there's a lot of, like, 90s buzzwords here. But then there's some of the terminology I just didn't... A lot of Christian's 1930s phrases didn't really make a lot of sense. But Cher and her friend Dion also say... Do they refer to women as Betties?
Yeah, it's kind of funny,
isn't
it?
That wasn't a term that made... Look, I don't think that's really survived.
Yeah. Do you think that is I mean, again, we're so far removed from number one being teenage girls, number two being teenage girls in the 90s, and also number three being teenage being girls American. In the 90s in Beverly Hills. So maybe there's like a cultural thing there. But I suspect this comes from the writing. It comes from Amy Heckering, Amy Heckling, who wrote and directed this, and, like, her vibe all the way through all the movies that she's done does have that kind of, like, slightly retro, slightly kind of, like, zeitgeisty, but not of the time, you know, trying to capture it like an age. And I think
apparently, apparently she did, like, and this is something that I noticed throughout the movie. She went and visited a high school.
Who is this woman?
She would go to do research to find out, like, you're making a movie about teenagers. You go and you find out what teenagers sound like. And that's what I mean about the terminology. I think that is sort of, like, ripped directly from how exactly children were talking in 1994 when she did have been doing this research. And that's why I think some of the phrasing, we're using the R word a lot in this movie, and that's like a real... We don't use the R word anymore. Like, that's not okay. You can't really say that. But in 94, in the 90s, you know, South Park and things, like, it was fine. It was, you know, it was edgy. It was like, oh, you're an edgy teenager, but it was fine. And there's a lot of gay slurs later on that we get all at once from Donald Faison, like, just a big condensed little speech of gay slurs.
Yes.
But, like, there's certain buzzwords and... You know, she's like, oh, like, totally, as if, and cool, and, you know, we still say cool. I say it 1,000 times a day still, even now.
Cool, man. Yeah, that's got to be pretty everlasting, isn't it? Perhaps the youth of today will, you know, stop using that because of their parents, as in me, still use it, and they're like, I'm not saying cool, it's cool, you know, I'm not using cool, I'm using, oh, it's totally sledge, man, like, they'll invent their new...
Literally. Like, start reading Clockwork Orange, right? Read the dictionary at the back of Clockwork Orange.
Yes, exactly.
And that is exactly what the young people will sound like. And it will be exactly as confusing. And it's designed so that we don't understand what they're saying. That's the whole point in youth culture, is to exclude old people.
Just like those MSN Messenger abbreviations that we use. Because we... Like the ones that were like... Can't talk, parents watching, you know, like, no one ever fucking used these. And all the boomers were just in hysterics. They were terrified that these young people were communicating without them knowing what's going on.
I'm sure I've mentioned it before, just while we're on text speak. I distinctly remember watching Blue Peter. I know. And
ask your parents.
They had some kids on to try and break the Guinness World Record for the fastest, like, typing of a text message.
Wow.
Like an actual text message with a phone keyboard, like,
yeah,
a,
the T9, you know, keyboard. Yep. So you had to just let's just stop a second and really revel in the absolute barbarism of have, if you wanted the letter C, you had to press 1-3 times. And then, like, I actually cannot believe that we put up with that for a lot longer than we should have, like 2000.
Yeah, but it's in a similar way to this movie where they do have cell phones, as you call them in America. They do have cell phones, but it's not like texting culture isn't quite there. But on this Blue Peter thing, it was like this teenage girl who was like texting with one hand, and it was like, you know, she got given a sentence, and then it was just
Shakespeare
into,
or
like mate or and all that, you know.
Oh yeah, M8, yeah, mate.
Or... M8, yeah, like all the sort of text contractions, and that sort of reminds me of stuff that's happening in this movie, because it has that sort of 80s vibe where, like, even though they've all got phones, there is certainly like an element of nobody ever knows. No one knows where anyone is at any time. Whereas, like, we could be further from that now.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? It's funny how like how the technology of the time is so important to like how movies are made, obviously, but like how also just the mechanics of the movies, how do things happen, and you get cell phones in this, we get a little bit of like computery stuff where she's getting dressed by that computer program
that's made up. Insane. That was one thing, the technology wise I was like, somebody needed to talk to a computer guy and be told, this is ridiculous. What are you talking about?
We are reaching. Although, as I was researching this movie, there was a CD-ROM game of this, of course. And the CD-ROM game had a similar type of thing where you could dress Silver Stone. In. So, like, it's not
impossible. It's some real Richie Rich
but
shit.
It's not happening. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's the other thing, isn't it? So we've got the technology, we've got the terminology, and it's another classic American Hollywood movie thing, which is everyone's rich, and like the disparity of wealth, I think, in this movie would be there if anyone else was even remotely not rich. Now we do get Ty, played by Brittany Murphy, who is like supposed to be a bit poorer, I think, but only she's only got one Ferrari in the mansion garage as opposed to 10.
I think it's kind of like presented in a, yes, she's poorer, but the implication is that New York's a shithole, which I think is like just an American fit. It's a film joke. It's a movie maker joke, isn't it? Because they all live in LA and work in LA, and it's like, isn't New York like a, you know, a third world country where they all talk like that?
The poverty is so much more like condensed there, as opposed to LA, where it's just massive and spread out, and we don't notice it as much. Yeah, totally. But that's another trope, isn't it? Of like these teen 80s movies that everyone's fucking stinking rich, and I think it's just like Silver Stone's character is just ridiculous. She's ridiculous in terms of like where she lives in the top 0.5% probably of Americans with a dad. You know, dad's a big fancy lawyer, and it's like,
yeah. Well, let's talk about the characters, maybe the plot a little bit in a second. I do want to touch on the fact that this is the, ring that bell, Sam. This is the second teen movie we've done based on classic literature.
Oh, well, really? See, that just shows how, in one hand, refined we are. And, you know, and also because most of our Shakespearean literature is through the lens of teen movies, also how fucking thick we are as well.
I fucking hate Shakespeare, just as a sidebar. When I was at school, I did media studies for GCSE. I mean, ask your fucking grandparent. Ask an English friend what that means. And not even a Scottish friend. You can't ask them because they don't know what that means.
Media studies.
I did media
was
studies,
great.
Which means that we didn't have to read any Shakespeare. We watched the Leonardo DiCaprio Shakespeare film for our Shakespeare. Because you have to do, everyone has to do a Shakespeare. We watched the Leonardo DiCaprio modern film where they've got guns, which is, I'd love to revisit because I don't remember.
Oh, I think that's
good.
A pretty good film, to be fair.
But Like, that's the form I want my Shakespeare in. This is the form I want my Jane Austen in. And I am a Philistine. I keep meaning to read Jane Austen. Not to have to, that I feel I have to defend myself. But that's that male, like, well, those are women. Those are books for women.
It's a woman's book, my lord.
Is Jane Austen this based on, isn't it? Emma. Or is it Emily Bronte?
Emma, yeah. This is based on, loosely, as in we've got a couple of characters that share the same name in the basic plot. Well,
I did read the plot, and basically the idea is the same, is that it's this woman who has grown up in pomp and luxury and has this inflated sense of, like, belief in herself. And this movie, I guess, actually, my only thing from reading I think is different is I think the book is harder about this woman's realization that, you know, she's not this precious, like, special, all-knowing individual, where I don't think Cher in this movie ever really has that kind of, like, down-to-earth moment where she realises that the world doesn't revolve around her.
There's no rock bottom, is there, for her? I think Cher's a lovely character, though, and we can talk about the actors in a second, but I think just as a character, I think the well-meaning optimism that just shines from her throughout the whole movie was surprising to me. It was surprising, and I think this comes from the source material. Emma in the book, from what I understand, has that similar type of kind of can't get her down. She's cheerful and optimistic about the world, and I was really waiting, and we have a tiny bit of it, but I was really waiting for that. That turn where she was going to become the mean girl, you know,
that's what we're used to. You've got the bitch. Mean Girls, great example. 10 Things I Hate About You, everyone's horrible in that film. That Winona Ryder film we did from the 80s that you didn't like, everyone's horrible in that. Like, we're used to teen movies where the girls especially are fucking horrible to one another. And that's something that, I think that's why this film, it was so popular and people love it so much, is it's just so positive. Like, it's a very optimistic, positive movie where generally everyone's quite nice to each other. There's not many characters who are kind of like written off as assholes. If any, I can't really think of many. Maybe the guy who robs Cher at gunpoint.
Yeah, but and maybe Elton, you know, who's trying to feel her up. That's not a good moment. And there is an argument, isn't there, between Cher and Ty. And you know this movie's good, right? Because we can remember all these fucking names, and we are terrible at that. We are terrible at remembering
names. We are trying to be better.
I'm not. I'm actively not trying to be better. And still, this movie got inside my head because I think the characterization is so good. And they, Cher and Ty, do have an argument at one point, but it comes off as like, well, this is just what friends do, and they're teenagers, and that's the type of stuff that happens.
Because they apologize to each other. And they hug and they make up. And it's kind of this realisation, like, we acted shittily. And it's a very almost grown-up way for teenagers to act. Of like, we behaved poorly, forgive me. And they're like, great.
Which perfectly brings me to my wider point about the characters. But also the whole movie is that it treats its subject matter with seriousness. And it respects the audience, the expected audience for this. It respects the fact that teenage girls are going to go see this, and what they want is actually a more realistic, a more grounded, while still being fun and wacky, but a more grounded version of what it's like to be a teenager, versus, you know, even the 80s version teen movies, which are a bit more depressing, a bit more grimy, and full of these like caricatures, like Breakfast Club style caricatures, where you've got the psycho and you've got the blah blah blah. And,
well, Fast Times at Ridgemont High would be the big example that also was directed by Amy, the same director as this movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you're right, and we still have those stereotypes in here. You've got, which have never really gone away. You've got the popular kids, you've got the stoners, you've got the reggae white guys. But I don't know why that's such an enduring trope in movies, but it really is. And you've got, you know, your chess club nerds, and it's that Mean Girls thing, isn't it? Where we get it's really on the nose in that film, and we get it in this movie. It's present. I particularly enjoyed the Cher's speech about how teenage boys dress like shit, and I was like, well, that's still true.
Yeah, but that is perfect, because I don't think I dressed quite like this. I, you know, I wasn't,
not as much tie dye in the middle when we were kids.
And maybe my trousers not quite down to you know, the bottom.
They were
of
baggy though,
but the bagginess of the, and her speech of like, why don't men, you know, why don't boys dress, and then haircut, and then they introduce
Christian.
What's his name, Christian, who dresses like he's in a 1950s gangster movie, and that's really fun.
Yeah, and he's an interesting character, isn't he? Because I think in a lazier movie, he's way camper.
Yeah, he'd be like super flamboyant and
exactly, and I think by not
all the horrible stereotypes
be like that,
yeah,
in this movie.
Yeah,
I think it makes it a better character, and it makes, like you said, it makes it age better, and it's just, you know, less abhorrent than, you know, like a Wayans Brothers movie would be, you know, just horrible. This character would be unwatchable.
Yeah. And there's so much to appreciate all the way down through the list of the cast. I think everyone's doing a really good job.
I love Dan Hedaya, the dad.
He
wasn't in enough stuff. Was in Cheers, famously, which you haven't seen. And Blood Simple, he's in that, gets murdered, it's great. Spoilers, I suppose. And
Joe Piscopo,
tons of other stuff.
Danny DeVito, he's in Wise Guys, he was in First Wives Club, that's a fun movie. Alien Resurrection. Yes, yeah.
He's all over the place. He's a really old-fashioned character actor who's like really interesting. He's not ugly, he's not overly like attractive. He's kind of in that gulf in between where he's just really interesting to look at.
Yeah. So all of this, I think, is really good. And I think the characters are, you can tell, I think, the research that Heckling did, because it really comes off the screen how well-developed these characters are and the interaction between them. And I think that's because we don't get the kind of like the mean girl vibe. We get a lot of positivity. We get a lot of kind of like, the girls coming together and looking after each other. I mean, it is, at the face of it, especially the way they treat Ty initially, is like they treat her a bit like a pet, you know, where they want to beautify her, they want to refine her, they want to...
We're going to help you become popular by making you exactly like us, which is a bad message. They never really, I guess, address, but like I said, it could be, again... It's the light hand of this movie and the positivity, and it's nobody in this movie, really, even Elton and Cher, like, no one's massively combative. Like, people bicker, but they don't argue. No one's throwing plates, you know, no one's crashing their car into someone's front room. It's quite chilled out. There's no even, like, you know, election. There's no, like, prom queen election. There's no, I'm going to win varsity something or other. I don't really understand American schools work. There's no class president thing. There's no graduation thing. There's no, like, do you know what I mean? There's it lacks the marker, that the traditional marker of the coming of age movie, where they don't really come of age in a way, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you said this when you were watching it, it felt like the movie just sort of ends, which it kind of does. But I would posit as well that it's maybe just missing like a lot. It like you should do traditional third act in a movie. It kind of veers away from.
We get the kind of, and there's more to talk about, but we get to the wedding, don't we? Which, I mean, you know what? In a lot of ways, the plot of this is I'm kind of like, I don't really care. And don't mean that in a bad way. I mean just whatever you want to tell me, movie, that's fine. Like, I'm happy just to be involved in this world and to be experiencing what these characters are experiencing. And I think a lot of that's because it's just fun and it's presented as fun, all the lightness, all the stuff we talked about already. But also, I think there's just a lot of, like, there's a lot of clever writing. There's a lot of very considered, I think, stories that drag us through almost separately in some ways, and it all ties up roughly at the end, but they are out very quick. But I mean, Christian and and share like their interaction as just a little story beat, almost a bit of a sketch that they have throughout the movie, which is that, you know, Cher thinks that Christian's into him and actually he's not. He's thinks she's a really nice friend, and but he's gay, so nothing like that's going to happen. And all of the kind of...
Similarly, it doesn't blow up, though. It's not like there's not a big accusatory parlor scene.
Yes.
When she fails a driving test, the movie doesn't then become about her passing her driving test. You know,
and her having to like, achieve anything. Yeah, totally.
I can see why this movie got passed around a lot before it got made, to be honest, because there's a lot in here that directors would be like, you know, oh, where's the big, you know, 7 car explosions at the end? You know, and it's... Because it's just nice, and mostly, honestly, most of the films we want the conflict, don't we? That's what the movie, the fulcrum by which the movie moves is the conflict, and this is kind of the opposite of that.
Yeah, yeah, and that I think that is a real, there's a real sleight of hand. There's a real deft touch to get that right.
And well, it allows you to just sort of live in the movie and not feel stressed out or.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the things that I enjoyed, I really enjoyed. There's lots of really funny throwaway lines. There's a bit where Christian's in the car with Cher, and because he's suave and he's sophisticated, and you know, he puts on, I hope you don't mind Billie Holiday, and she says, oh, I love him, which is well, I wasn't going to throw you under the bus, but it's a great joke because Billie Holiday is a woman who was a jazz singer in the 1930s and died in like 57. So there's no reason for any teenager in the 90s to know who the hell she was unless you're into jazz music. Similarly, David, there is not a reason for you as a 30-year-old man to really know if you're not into jazz. But it's so there's all these like multi-layered jokes.
The embarrassing thing is, I do know who Billie Holiday is. I just, in my brain, you know, when you sort of like spark that connection, I heard Billie Holiday and my brain wrote down Buddy Holly. So when you said, oh, I love him, I was like, yeah, he's a weird
you love Buddy Holly.
I love Buddy Holly too. Buddy Holly's an odd pull. And then I was like, but then I was thinking, and then they go on to not play any Billie Holiday music. Buddy Holly music. Because I knew that. I knew it wasn't Buddy Holly, the music, but I just thought that it was like a dropped line. And then, I felt like quite stupid, really.
You shouldn't, because the joke is, I think, remembering this is a movie for teenage girls, is that this pretentious prick, as in me, is like, oh, I'm going to put some Billie Holiday on. And the character in the movie...
I did feel personally attacked when he puts on Some Like It Hot. And I was like, that's a fantastic movie. What a great choice to sit and watch on Saturday night.
And then, so let me just finish that because it's a whole other great joke. And then for the character in the movie to be like, I have no idea who it is, but I'm going to pretend to try and impress this, which is pretty much what most of the teenage girls watching this at the time were thinking as well, which is just great. That joke, Dave, is fucking brilliant. So they're watching Spartacus and they talk about, she's trying to teach Ty to, you know, try and improve her vocabulary and use the word sporadic, and then later on is this sporadicus, and there's just like it's just, you know, it's all of this detail, all of this,
because
absolutely
occasionally
wonderful detail.
You sort of see through too many teen movies have that Joss Whedon effect, where like Buffy, for instance, which I love, but where everyone's ultra confident and they're saying and articulate, if only I was articulate, eh? They're super articulate and confident and clever. And in this movie, if you weren't really paying attention, you could kind of be led to believe that these characters are the same. But if you listen to the words that they're saying, you can really clearly discern that it's teenagers like trying to sound clever as opposed to actually being clever.
Yes.
And ironically, the character who is the most obvious is Paul Rudd's girlfriend that we see briefly, who I can't remember what she actually says. And
she's
Cher actually knows better than her because of her private education.
No. Cher knows. So they're talking about who Hamlet is. And Cher knows who Hamlet is because she's seen the Mel Gibson version.
Oh, of course.
Again, like multi-layered jokes, jokes that mean something to...
It's clever. It's the way this movie's aged as well, talking about being personally attacked. There's a great line from Cher, and it's there's loads of Radiohead in this movie, as we discussed between ourselves. Because obviously we're two white men in our 30s, we fucking love Radiohead.
I'm a creep. Yeah.
Let's not start. We're not a music podcast, Sam. I can't maintain that. You can play the guitar, do a little bit of singing, and I will sit here quietly because I am not good at
that. Sounds perfect. I think our audience is only going to grow.
I'm quite into it, to be honest. Might get a bit too sexual for the podcast world, just going to say. But in this movie, Cher, Paul Rudd's character is the stepbrother, and he's at college. He's kind of written to be sort of 18, 19, a couple of years older. And he's doing that, like, and his whole character is kind of like, he's doing that, yeah, I'm a, because he's like a grown up and she's a child, and there's that sort of posturing that all 18 and 19 year olds do, where you're not really a grown up, don't be so silly, but also legally you are, and therefore fuck you, I'm all knowing, I know everything, I'm clever, I'm worldly with all my 8 months of adult life experience. Yeah. And she sort of shouts, he's listening to Radiohead, I think it's Fake Plastic Trees play on the radio, and the line is something like, oh, what is this, like, poser college shit, or, you know, you shouldn't say shit, but this poser college, like, it's, a radio.
It's complaint rock, which is just the most, and if everyone else has been using that phrase to describe Radiohead, Coldplay, you know, a string of other 2000s
all emo. The music we like, that's right.
Absolutely. I'm adding it to my repertoire.
It's funny because
complaint rock is
a moment of
genius.
It's a moment of self-awareness. All the characters in this movie have these moments of checking somebody else's posturing while simultaneously doing quite a lot of posturing themselves. I think every character in this movie does it, because Paul Rudd does it, Cher does it a couple of times, the Dion, the best friend, does it. Like, all the fleshed out characters in this movie are quite flawed in terms of, you see through the facade of the, I'm a grown up, I'm an adult.
Yeah, which is by design. And that's where I think your point about Buffy and a lot of, I mean, 10 Things I Hate About You, previous episode, is
that's
dripping.
A lot of 40-year-old high schoolers.
Because shock horror, it's written by 40-year-old men, or it's written by even, I think, less accomplished, you know, right.
And this isn't the only example of this. I think other movies do this reasonably well. I think Mean Girls is pretty balanced in terms of that as well.
But what's important, though, is that I think it allows you then to empathize just that bit more, because you're not trying to, these aren't personas of characters. I think they're real, you know, they are still like snapshots, but we get a lot deeper. The movie does have that classic thing of, like, everyone's super confident. We've got a guy who's gay.
I feel like I'd
in
be
the
pretty
ninth...
confident if I was that rich.
Yeah, if you're that rich. But we've got a gay guy in the 90s openly quite happy for everyone to know, watching Tony Curtis movies and listening to Billie Holiday. Like, so there's some stuff which kind of reads as like enhanced, but also that's, I think, an important thing of the slight slurs aside, of like being a bit aspirational about, actually, you should be able to walk, you know, be gay in high school, and that's fine. Like, we're not quite there yet, obviously, as a culture in the 90s. We've got a long way to go. Talking to you, Friends, the TV show. Yes, I'm talking to you. Like, but I think it's a great sense of, well, these things are possible, and it should just be okay. You know, we shouldn't remark on it too much.
Yeah,
although obviously
quite,
the movie,
like you said, it's
does
quite
fall
aspirational
down.
In that way. It's a fun view of high school. Like, nobody's getting bullied really at school, like, apart from the teachers, quite a lot. But
this little romance plot, this beautiful little,
it's charming, isn't it? It's charming.
I love
Wallace Shawn whenever I see him. Great Star Trek.
100%. Rex from Toy Story. Like, is there a man with a better, more expressive voice? I'm not sure there is. You know, he's just absolutely brilliant, really, really fun. And all the way through the movie, there's all of these adult characters that are, I think, again, like, they're not what you would expect from a 90s teen movie, where they are also stereotypes, so they're also caricatures. And I think it adds a lot because it humanizes them. You know, the fact that they spend a large portion of the movie trying to get these two teachers to fall in love. And
they don't try very hard, honestly.
No, these are some thirsty teachers, I think, is the modern phrase.
I think the subtext is that these two, like, that people in their late 40s don't have as much time to mess about.
And you work in a
which
school.
Is, again, like, there's a certain amount of truth here in, like, these people, yes, and there's also kind of like a, we talked about the vulnerability of the teenagers in this movie when they're kind of outed as, like, not as uber confident as they look, and I think the teachers are the much more realistic portrayal of that, where, like, they're both quite nervous about this, despite the fact that they're both knocking on 50. I think, like, you know, they're both a bit like, oh, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, and you also see that with the coach as well, who looks like she's gay too, and so there's just all of this.
I think,
like,
that's
this,
a line in the movie as well.
Yeah, there's all of this. Just there's lots of thinking going on. It feels like it doesn't get it right, obviously. And, you know, what do we know as you know, two idiots as well? But I just think that if you're going to create a movie, if you're going to create a universe for your movie to live in, and then you're going to get the characters to do whatever they're doing inside of it, to add so much tapestry, to add so much richness, I think is, like, one of my favorite things about movies. I love films that aren't just about what's happening, they're also about the world that we get to,
yeah,
get
and
a snapshot of
that,
you know,
sort of core thing that the start of movies are, like, before we had complex narratives that are sort of set in stone now. And, like, sometimes you just want to be looking at something, and I think TV sometimes is a bit looser and is a bit more able to do that, but this film is a great example of the production design is really good. Like, there's a real intentionality behind all of the costuming. The cast is working really well, and yes, the stakes aren't particularly high or even present, to be perfectly honest. I don't miss a single ticking clock in this movie. Nobody's rushing to the airport. Like, nobody has to pass their final. You know, it's much more relaxed in that way, and sometimes it's nice to just watch that movie like that and just enjoy what's going on the screen. On the base level of it's nice to look at, and it's interesting, and it's fun, and it's light, you know? Yeah. Not everything has 17. You know, with 12 9/11s at the end of it. Like, sometimes it's okay to just have a film where...
Just,
like,
have one 9/11. That's fine. Like, that's okay.
The only piece of, like, what's the word? Like, the only way this could go wrong for Cher is if she doesn't get together with her stepbrother, which, you know, I'm also fine.
Like, this is where I think I'm going to bring in the negative, because I was watching this and I saw the runtime at the start. It's like 1:37. Great. We started it at like 9 o'clock at night. We can finish this before we start getting tired. Excellent. Fine. And then as I'm going through, I was like, movie, you've got 4 minutes left. Like,
where are we going?
What's happening? What's going on here? And I'm a bit hazy then, because it did happen so quick and I've only seen this once, but there's like an epiphany and Cher wants to have a bit more of a purposeful life. Like, she becomes a little bit less of a materialistic and a little bit less of, like, you know, her kind of existence is, and
yeah, her redemption arc. So the start of the movie is the setting up the teachers. Then we have Ty and Christian, and it's kind of, and that really is just like, oh, we're watching teenagers do things and it's going nowhere. And then you have the all is lost moment. Traditionally, I'm jamming the save the cat theory on here. Yeah, the all is lost moment, which is the argument with Ty, and then you have the apologising to Ty, telling her that it's okay that she's interested in what's his name?
Josh Paul Rudd.
No, I mean...
Oh. Give me a guess.
Birkenstock.
Breckenmeyer.
Movies playing this exact role. Exactly. He really made money on being a stoner. Anyway, telling it was okay to be with Brooklyn Meyer, we get the skateboarding thing, you have the food drive, and again, it's that because somebody said to her, I think it's Ty says to her, like, you're a spoiled, and it's, she's not rude about it, really. You're spoiled, you know, you have everything you've ever wanted, and that gets home to her, and the law associate as well says something similar to her, you're a child, you don't know what you're doing. And so you get the food drive and the, I'm going to start giving back, I'm going to be nicer. She goes around and apologizes to all her friends. We get like a nice cutaway moment to Dion and Murray, like just being, you know, pleasant, just being bros to each other. Like, not mm-hmm. bros, but just being pleasant. And there's a lot of that in this movie.
Donald Faison showing up as Murray Duvall.
Donald Faison, who...
Scrubs.
I love Donald Faison. Fuck you. The internet, I'm going to say it. I really, really enjoyed Scrubs in 2010. I really, really loved it.
I don't think that's controversial.
It is not as good as it was then. But
all right. Yeah. See, that's the thing, is it? Does it hold up? And I think it's like, I think the word might be just, it's just a bit basic. You know what I mean? That show is just like not really touching the sides.
I will say
about
that,
anything.
Talking about Donald Faison, the one thing about Scrubs which I think does hold up a little bit is the... And it does get a bit old because the series constantly has to readdress it, is the fact that it's okay for these two guys to be affectionate toward one another.
Yes.
That is the one thing in that series which I think stands out, is that these two guys love each other, they're just really good friends, and that's okay. It's okay for them to be affectionate and for them to tell each other
they love each
other. Toxic
masculinity. Thank you very much.
I know. And it's baby steps. It really, really was baby steps in... When did Scrubs come out? Like 2005, 2006. Yeah. Like, it's tiny, tiny steps, but...
In 20 years, it's going to be okay for two guys on a podcast to say, Dave, I love you, man. I just... You're one of my best friends, and I really appreciate... Your talent.
Sam, come on now. The public don't want to hear us gushing.
There it is.
You see, it's
toxic masculinity. You can't do it. Sort yourself out, Dave.
I know. I need to have a word with myself.
Didn't even tell how much you love me.
Doesn't have a problem telling each other their feelings. It's these two siblings. I think it's fine. I think in the context of the movie, I think it's like.
I'm not sure about it.
I'm not sure about it, Dave.
I think the whole ending of the movie,
I really think
is like...
Like,
what?
In the context of the movie, these two aren't siblings. I think that's established. Like, they are like... No. Hear me out here. I'm not... Because what I'm saying is that they are neither related, nor did they grow up together. Like, they knew each other as children. And
but
then,
Do they share... They don't share any type of parent then?
No, Dan Hedaya is Cher's dad, and he was briefly married to Paul Rudd's mum.
And his dad is a different...
Different man. And what he says, because the line is, when we first meet Josh, is Dan Hedaya says, oh, Josh is coming round. And she says, oh, Josh, I hate him. You divorced his mum. What are you even doing? And he's like, listen, and I love this line from him. It's like, you divorce wives, you don't divorce children.
Yes.
Dan Hedaya is such a good dude in this movie.
He's a great, I know. I mean,
he's like,
a bit hard.
This kid
good.
Lived with us for, like, I think we're told, like, a couple of years when he was 10. And he's like, hey, I was in this kid's life. I'm not just suddenly not going to be in his life and not going to be there
for him
just
man.
Because I divorced his mother.
Good
That's
for
a
you.
Good message.
But I still got to say, even if it's, like, when he was... 10, and that means she was going to be 8. It's still a bit weird. And I just think, fine movie, that's fine. You could have maybe made him like a foreign exchange student, or you could have maybe, you know, like you could have done something, couldn't you? Maybe. But anyway, I think it's just more than...
I think
more,
it's fine.
More
I agree.
Of my complaint, though,
I could have also done with it, like, I didn't really need the... You could have just had the... They develop a mutual respect for one another.
Totally. That is my point. Yeah.
Yeah, because it feels a bit like we've got to have that scene at the table later where everyone has a boyfriend.
Yeah, yeah. And I just think, like, because you don't get to see any of the ending, and I'm not going to say that I wanted more of this because I love a movie that's like, see ya. we're not going to drag this out any longer than you need to. Fantastic. But I do think either give me some significance, because I didn't really get, like, these two having this really close sexual chemistry all that for that much of the movie. It was only slightly towards the end when she has this kind of realization that she wants a boyfriend, and hey, there's one here and he lives with me. Cool. Like, it doesn't feel like that's going to go
I think
much
they have good
further.
Chemistry, not sexual chemistry. I think they have good chemistry throughout this movie. And that's kind of the basis of it. And I guess you've paid Paul Rudd, and therefore you want that resolution.
But they have bickering kind of sibling like chemistry, Dave. This is important. They have bickering sibling chemistry. And she's walking, you know, she's obviously...
I don't know, Sam. Watch anything. Look at Friends. How many flashbacks do we get to them all being children together? Not children, obviously, because they're 40-year-old people.
It's a small thing.
Like,
but
what I'm saying is, let's not ring the incest horn here. Let's just, like, give them a pass.
Hey, at the very most, I am dingling a small bell. Ding-ling-ling. That's all I'm doing, right? I'm not. There's no horns involved here. What I'm saying is that I didn't quite believe it. And then the movie, because I think it kind of knows you're not going to believe actually seeing them as a couple, we get the tossed Mr. Hall.
Why are these miserable teachers inviting all these heinous kids to their wedding?
I
get inviting Cher on some level and Dion, but like Brecklyn Myers there, the horrible girl from the debate class is there. Why are all the kids there?
Yeah, because it's a movie. But we get the bouquet throw, they catch it, they kiss, and then the movie's like, we're out of here, because if you see 10 seconds more of these two together, you could be like, aren't they like siblings, basically? And it's fine.
I would love for the internet to give us a thing here, but I really, especially for Hollywood standards, I really don't think this is like problematic.
Yeah, I bet
I get what
is.
You're saying, Sam, but how many movies like can we name where the romantic couple in the movie have known each other since they were five, and I don't see this is any different.
Yeah.
Like, except they happen to live in the same house briefly. Like, it's...
I think I know where we need to go with this, which is fanfiction.net/clueless. And there is just loads of it, Dave. There's just loads of
well,
it.
Well, I will leave you, Sam, to do some on-the-ground research there, and you can enjoy that.
A father's
this
approval.
This is a weird sort of
Hold
movie
on.
For me.
Mel's reaction to finding out that Cher and Josh's relationship has changed. You're not my brother. Superficial Space Cadet. The development of Josh and Cher's relationship in Clueless and beyond from Josh's perspective. Perfectly sticks to canon. Fantastic. Wow.
I'm not sure I want any of that in my life. What I was going to lead into from there is that I like this movie, and I liked this movie when I first saw it, and I liked it again when I watched it last night. And I'm sure I'll like it if I see it again. But it's because it's so without stakes that even when you compare it to Hackers, which I did say we'd come back to, Hackers is a movie I think like I would be excited to watch again, you know, on any occasion. Whereas this, I'd be interested to see it, but it's never gonna top 10 Things I Hate About You or Mean Girls, or, you know, I could list tens of teen movies, but it's never going to be high on that list, despite the fact that I don't dislike it in any way, really.
That's interesting. That's
it. You know what I mean? I think it's because it lacks that excitement and that.
I thought you were going to go the other way there. I thought you were going the other way to say Hackers isn't a film I would want to sit down and be excited to watch, but this would be. Because that's kind of where I am. Like, as much as I really like 10 Things I Hate About You, and I like a lot of these genre movies, these kind of teen rompy rom-coms, but I think, yeah, I don't know. I really enjoyed this. I thought this was really fun. I was engaged all the way through, and it's the type of movie that I think rewatching, you'd kind of gain more. Maybe because I've only seen it once, and you've seen it multiple times, you've lost that kind of like quotability thing, but I think this is a movie that you could just be, it could just be dripping with lines and quotes, and you know how we've kind of got that like lexicon in our
absolutely, and that's the reason this movie was as popular enjoyed. As it was.
Yeah, it's kind of a cult thing, isn't it? Yeah,
because I think as a teenager, you would watch this movie and you would identify with one of the characters, and then it would become your favorite movie. We talked about this with Election. There's a sort of similar vibe there where you're going to watch it. Election is not a good example, but like other teen movies where the reason that they become cult classics is because teenagers watch them and watch them and watch them and watch them and watch them.
And could watch them.
There's another movie from 1995, Empire Records, which I'm not sure you've seen.
No.
Which is another cult movie that's kind of like just a touch aged up from this. And that is, we should do it because I think there's a lot to sort of explore in the what's in the zeitgeist and what makes a movie like this sort of last the test of time, I think.
Yeah. And I think what happens in a period of VHS as well, you know, when this can be captured and this can be replayed and it can really cement itself and, you know, kind of be that long term winner, you know, like that movie that's gonna hold out over the generations. So yeah. Speaking of winners, let's do this. Yes, that music can mean only one thing. It's the semi-relevant movie quiz, the quiz where we try and stump each other with stupid questions that are kind of about 1995's Clueless. We've got three questions each, and whoever gets the most questions right wins this prestigious award for tardiness. Well done, Dave.
We're
talking Clueless.
You won last week, I believe.
Of course, I'm a winner.
Right. And that means that you get to go first this week. Also, because I think I went first last week.
Okay, well, we can do that. Let's try and keep track of it, because I do want to be able to hold this over you as some kind of quantifiable difference in our, you know,
I think I'm still ahead by one.
Roll the tape. No, we won't do it. So, question one.
Let's go to the archives. The archives are incomplete.
I've got it loaded up. Question one. So, we're talking about Clueless, and this is famously based, as we've discussed, on Jane Austen's 1816 novel, Emma. But which of the following other Austen novels have been adapted for TV and film the most? Is it A, Pride and Prejudice? Is it B, Sense and Sensibility? Is it C, Emma? So which of those three has been adapted for TV and film the most, based on my rough look at Wikipedia?
You know, I was certain I knew the answer when you asked that, because I'm certain it's Pride and Prejudice. I'm still leaning that way. It's definitely not Emma, I think.
You're certain? Wow.
No.
Okay.
I'm doing the Slumdog Millionaire thing. I know, and I'm... listening to me ramble, all right?
What I'm doing is I'm unnerving you through that process.
Now, I thought Pride and Prejudice, right, because I'm familiar with it. It's the Mark Darcy thing. There's a million remakes and adaptations of different Pride and books and film. Are we talked about just about TV here?
TV and film. Yeah.
TV and film.
Basically, what's on the Wikipedia pages, I just counted them. So.
But Sense and Sensibility isn't something I'm super familiar with, but that could cut both ways, where I'm not super familiar with it, so I'm not super aware of how many thousands of movies have been made about it. I think I'm going to stick with Pride and Prejudice. First thought, best thought. I don't know enough about Sense and Sensibility. Again, Jane Austen is a bit of a blank spot. It's something I've been meaning to listen to some audiobooks and, you know, educate myself, because I like classic literature, and it's just... again, it's that toxic masculinity. I'm like, well, it's Jane Austen.
It's, you can't help yourself, Dave. It's okay.
I'm
going to
read Charles Dickens. I'm going to read
Man
Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. So you're locking in Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
Ding, indeed, and it is by a country mile. So this is again roughly 39 TV shows and films for Pride and Prejudice.
How many of them star Colin Firth?
More than you would like them to do. The next is Emma at 12, and then Sense and Sensibility at 8. There's a range of Pride and Prejudice has got loads, obviously.
Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, isn't there?
Well, that's one of the ones. We've also got Bridget Jones, Lost in Austin, which is a TV series, which is quite fun. And then, yeah, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. I think it's probably the most famous, wasn't it? So, well done, you get a
certainly, yeah,
point.
The most famous work, definitely.
Good man. Right, now this question is slightly complicated, but just stay with me, because it is a semi-relevant movie, because remember, so we can do whatever we like.
I'll just wait for my questions.
Yeah. So, writer-director Amy Heckling also has the Look Who's Talking franchise in her filmography. The third and final film, Look Who's Talking Now, includes Danny DeVito and Diane Keaton playing which of the following three character pairs? So, Look Who's
Can I say what I think it is before you give me the options?
No, I'll give the options because that's
please,
how quizzes
because
work.
Because I think I know what it is.
Oh, are you just going to blow out this whole the whole quiz format?
I
want to
hear your things, but I think it's the baby sister and the dog.
Okay.
But
so,
let me hear the options.
Is it TJ and Susie? Have you seen the third one, by the way, actually?
I mean, statistically, probably.
I know you certainly
probably. I couldn't tell you a thing about it, though.
So
is
Danny
he a pilot
DeVito,
or a limo driver?
Danny DeVito and Diane Keaton in the third Look Who's Talking, do they play TJ and Susie, two bumbling thieves, Albert and Rosie, a pair of wisecracking parrots, or Rox and Daphne, the family's dogs?
Oh, it's the dogs.
Are you
definitely
sure?
The dogs. Yeah, because I'm fairly sure Danny DeVito plays a dog.
What about the parrots?
No, I'm fairly sure it's dogs.
You could have confused the animals, is what I'm saying.
No, I think it's dogs.
Final answer?
Final answer, dogs.
Fucking you sad shit. I can't believe you've seen that fucking movie. So this film was
Do you know what it is? Do you know what it is? For some reason, I feel like we've talked about the fact that they got Danny DeVito in and then they got him to voice a dog. And I was like, that's a weird sort of like, I'm sure we've talked about it before.
He does. He plays Rox and Daphne, Diane Keaton, Danny DeVito.
Diane Keaton, what are you doing with your life? DeVito,
hold on.
He doesn't mind slumming.
Travolta and Kirstie Alley return. And it lost $12 million at the box office. As a 0%
they were lucky it wasn't more.
I mean, this is insane. And the reason this happened, and the reason the second one happened as well, is because the first Look Who's Talking had a budget of $7.5 million and made $297 million.
Is the baby voiced by Bruce Willis? Am I imagining?
Exactly. That is exactly true. Yeah. But in the third one, the kids have grown up, so
wow.
They don't have.
We should do Look Who's Talking, because I bet it's trash. I bet it's the trashiest.
I think the first one's okay.
Trashed.
I think the first one's like.
You heard it, ladies and gentlemen.
For a kids' movie, it's probably all right. Well done. 2 out of 3 points so far, then. Well done. Well done. Now, this is going to go into our back catalogue a little bit. So, Alicia Silverstone starred 2 years later in the career-destroying Batman and Robin as Batgirl. But which of the cast and crew had the most nominations for Batman and Robin at the Golden Raspberry Awards? Is it A, George Clooney? Is it B, Chris O'Donnell? Or is it C, Alicia Silverstone? So which of these had the most nominations at the Golden Raspberry Award in 1998 or whatever?
Well, I mean, knowing how unfair the world is, the fact that George Clooney went on to have a very successful career after this movie probably means he was the worst part of that movie. You say Chris O'Donnell, was it?
Yeah, so Batman, Robin, or Batgirl.
Yeah, Robin. He was a weird sort of like, you are right, career-killing movie. I was looking into this because Alicia Silverstone, I always thought, like, why did she just... And seemingly, because I was like, on the edge of my mind, I was like, oh, there was some big scandal, like she was abused or something. And I was like, nope, thank God. Apparently, according to her, she just wasn't enjoying herself. And like, she'd made loads of money and she was like, this isn't fun. You know, I'm not enjoying... And so she just stopped.
She still acted a bit afterwards, and she's still doing stuff. She's kind of like gone into like an anti-vaxxer thing though. Ooh. And she has supported that Kennedy dude in the next election, so it's definitely not great on that front. Fantastic. But that's really, I think it all comes back to this movie. Similarly with Chris O'Donnell, George Clooney managed to ER his way out of
fairness,
it.
In fairness, the nipples on that bat suit should have gotten all the golden raspberries. What are we doing? Why are we putting nipples on a fucking superhero costume? God, that movie is... I think I've only seen that movie twice, maybe. Like, it's so bad.
If you want to hear our thoughts, go back and listen to that previous episode.
Have we done that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Sure? We have. I'm pretty sure we have.
No, I think we've only done the one with... I think we've done Batman and Robin, the Schwarzenegger one.
That's this one.
No, it's not.
Yeah, it is.
You sure?
100%.
With the Batman credit card?
I can't remember that far back. But Batman and Robin is the one with Uma Thurman and Schwarzenegger and holy rusted metal Batman.
Wow. That is the one with the Batman credit card. It's because he's Poison Ivy spread to...
Yeah, episode 111.
Fair enough. Go back. I think that Chris O'Donnell is the Golden Raspberry winner.
Chris O'Donnell, was he? Did he have the most nominations for the Golden Raspberry?
Killed his career. Dead.
Correct. Well done, Dave. Fantastic.
3 for 3.
It's very impressive. Now, every single actor got a nomination. The main cast, anyway, and they all got one, but. O'Donnell got worst supporting actor. Plus, this is great. He got one alongside George Clooney in his only nomination for worst screen couple.
There is a lot of homoerotic vibes in that movie. Again, oh, yes. Refer back to our homoerotic podcast about it.
But Silverstone, she did get the win. She won the worst supporting actress for that performance in a heinous movie. That is destroyed at least two actors' careers. Crazy.
Yeah.
So well done, Dave. Well done.
That's a good week for me. That's a good week for me.
3 for 3.
Good luck getting mine right.
Oh, fuck's sake. See, this is where you're a piece of shit, because I spent ages trying to think of questions that are actually achievable to get without randomly knowing. So yeah, I expect to be fucked.
There's a logic basis here, right? So... Everyone knows that the true star of Clueless is Dan Hedaya, right?
Hold on, let me just Google who that is.
Right, so, this movie was spun off into a TV series, which we'll get to. There's some other questions related to that, called Clueless, which I never saw. Now, Dan Hedaya famously starred in Cheers, as Carla's scuzzy ex-husband, and he got his own spin-off before Frasier. There was another spin-off to Cheers before Frasier, called The Tortellis, starring Dan Hedaya. Now,
oh my God,
how many episodes did The Tortellis run before it was cancelled? Was it A, 6, B, 13, or C, 22?
This is a fucking outrage, by the way, Dave. This is an absolute outrage of a question. Who the fuck? I have no idea.
Well, there's a logic basis here, right?
Is there a logic basis?
How long is there a logic basis? American TV series is
right. So
Frasier is a spin-off of Cheers. How many episodes? So 20... in the first series of that. You know.
Yeah.
Okay. That was obviously wildly successful. Arguably more successful.
All right.
Than
all
Cheers.
Right. All right. All right. Let's go through the process then. So I think that 6 is too few. There's not many that only last for 6. Like, that's getting cancelled.
6 is bad. 6 is, you are right.
Within, like, you're like, oh, we are actively offending the audience by what we're putting out on TV.
We're gonna be bombed.
Advertisers are phoning in saying, do not put our adverts against this. You know, like,
I mean, by all accounts, The Tortellis was pretty bad. I've never been able to find it streaming. I would love to watch a bit of it. But
I'm
never
sure
even
it's
been
on
able to
some,
find it.
Yeah, beyond some.
But there's a backdoor pilot in Cheers where all of the cast of the new spin-off, they depart Cheers to go and be in the spin-off. Like, they just leave the bar to go to wherever they're going to have their spin-off.
it really underlines just how bafflingly successful Frasier was. Like, fuck me, they were throwing out. They couldn't get enough of these spin-offs, and it just, none of them landed except for Frasier. It's bizarre. It's insane.
Well, I mean, insane. 12 years and then a reboot 20 years later. I mean, it's a good landing.
It's pretty good. So I'm going to say that if we're talking 20-odd episodes for a 1980s TV run, did it get cancelled before the end of the first season, which would leave 13 left?
It did, correct.
Yes! Ding for me.
I think 13. It was one of those interesting ones where they didn't make many more than, I think they might have made 14 or 15. They hadn't, because obviously they got cancelled midway, and usually, you know, you're not that, you haven't done 22 episodes in the middle of the season. Usually you're still in production. Yeah, apparently it was horrible, and I remember not liking, because it's Dan Hedaya's character in Cheers, and it's all of Carla's, some of Carla's kids and his new wife, and they move to Las Vegas or something. And I remember the episode in Cheers where they go, and it's like, oh, this is a fucking boring episode. Because he's a terrible character in Cheers. And then you have the Tortellis, and it's just fucking, and I cannot believe they managed to get Frasier greenlit after that, because
incredible. Baffling. Incredible. It's got John Ratzenberger, it's got George Wendt, it's got Rhea Perlman. I mean, it's got the whole fucking lot of them. And yeah, like, that's television writer Bill Kelly wrote, the Italian-American Anti-Defamation League should be about as enchanted with Nick Tortelli as it was with the Untouchables. What a fantastic sentence.
It's quite bad.
Well done.
Now, question number two. We're sticking with the TV adaptation theme. So, as I mentioned, this movie was adapted into a TV series based on the success of it.
Okay.
A lot of the main cast came back. Alicia Silverstone did not. She was recast. But Donald Faison was in it. And the woman who played Dion was in it. And I think Wallace Shawn appeared for an episode. And there was, like, you know, quite a few of the cast appeared. Not Dan Hedaya, oddly. I think he was done with TV by this point.
Okay.
And it ran for 62 episodes.
So this is the Clueless TV show.
It's the Clueless TV show.
Right.
Right. Now, I never saw this series. However, it had a crossover with another popular children's teen TV show in the 90s. Was that crossover with... I mean, this is just guesswork. Was that crossover with Clarissa Explains It All?
Outrageous.
Sabrina the Teenage Witch or Teen Angel? Have you seen any of those?
I've seen Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Pretty sure I've seen Teen Angel.
We used to watch Clarissa Explains It All and Teen Angel as well. Teen Angel was a weird movie where the main character's an angel because he eats a burger from under his friend's bed and dies and goes to heaven. And then he's an angel who's haunting his best friend who's at high school. It's a bizarre greenlit.
That makes perfect sense to me.
Probably three or four season series.
God, if that can be made, then what else isn't being made? You know, how bad could it possibly get?
The 90s seem like a particularly... they're just throwing shit at the wall.
Let me just break down your incredibly convoluted question. So, the Clueless TV series had a crossover with one of the three you just mentioned there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
As in, the main character from one of those series appeared in Clueless as that character.
Okay, so it came the other way. So it came from Sabrina to that or whatever the show was.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't got a fucking clue. I'm going to go on the base purely on the basis that I have seen it and I remember it. It had a cat and it had the woman who played Sabrina in it.
What was the cat called? What's the first word that comes to your mind if I say witches? American witches.
Salem. Thank you.
Salem the cat.
I would have got there. I would have got there. I would have got there. Just it would have taken me about 3 hours.
I bet, by the way, I bet that doesn't hold up. I bet that show. We loved that show as kids. It was the most fun. And I bet it's...
It was like a little slice of America, wasn't it?
I never see anyone go to bat for that series. Like, you know, on the online...
Didn't it get remade? I'm sure it did.
Well, it's based on an Archie comic. Like the IP, Sabrina the Teenage Witch. So it's not that Sabrina the Teenage Witch, the 90s show, got remade. It's that they took the original story that that's sort of loosely based on and adapted that into a new TV series.
Wow. Wow, I'm just looking. There doesn't seem to be any sign of a remake just yet.
There was a Sabrina the Teenage Witch TV show on Netflix about 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
Oh, there we go. That'll be it. Yeah. Wow.
Sorry, I thought I was clear when I agreed with you there.
Strap. Right, so... yeah, I'm going to go Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Fuck it. I don't know. You're a dickhead who's making these questions way too difficult for me to answer. So, fuck you.
You know, when I did them, I really thought you got the first one right. Right, didn't you?
Barely.
You logicked your way out of it, right?
There's still logic to this, though, is there?
No. Tell me. You are right, though. So, yes! You can't really complain. Yeah, I will just stop complaining.
What a great quiz this is. I love this quiz. On condition that I get the next one right.
Don't worry, there's no way you get the next one right.
Oh, fuck.
So there was a crossover, which I find really bizarre, that Sabrina the Teenage Witch, a mildly sci-fi character with magic powers and a talking cat.
What? I've just actually realised what the hell's going on then. So they've got this magic character. Does she use magic on the Clueless show?
I don't know. I might look
David,
into it.
David, why haven't you researched this? Why haven't you researched this?
I thought the fact alone was weird enough without me delving into, like, finding clips from this, like,
listener, prepare
show.
Yourselves for a 17-episode series as we delve into what the hell is happening. We'll talk, what, like, 25 minutes long. We'll do 4-minute chunks over an hour, all right? And we'll do that for as long as it takes to get through that episode. Like, comment, yeah. Subscribe.
Fair enough.
Next question.
The next question is that, maintaining my theme of spin-offs, this movie was directed by Amy Heckling, as we've mentioned, a whoa woman, and quite a successful director, by all accounts, apart from, obviously, Look Who's Talking 3. Now, 3.
She didn't direct that, by the way. Anyway.
But she directed the first one.
First one.
3 of her movies were adapted to television shows. Clueless was adapted. And as I've mentioned, there were 62 episodes of Clueless.
Very respectable. Yeah.
Very respectable. Also adapted was Fast Times at Ridgemont High was adapted into Fast Times in the 80s. And Look Who's Talking was adapted into a TV series called Baby Talk.
Wow.
Now.
Someone's getting checks. Someone's getting paid.
I mean, I guess.
What's your question? What's your fucking question, caller?
Every successful film will be adapted into a television series because they want more blood from that stone.
And then a video game, and then it'll go back from a video game to a TV show.
And then a novelization, and then an audiobook of that novelization, and then that will be adapted into a video game, which will be adapted into a TV show. Then that TV show, based on that video game, based on that novelization, will be adapted back into a film.
My favorite example of this is the copy of the book that I do own, which is the novelization of the Deep Space Nine episode where they go back in time and watch The Trouble with Tribbles.
Yes. That's
I saw amazing. It was on Amazon for like £2.80. It was like, I'm never going
to
read it.
I've also got this book because we were going to read it. Have you tried to read it?
No. I haven't even.
It spends way too much time talking about how sexy Dax is. There's like 4 pages at the very beginning talking about how well this costume fits. And you're like,
good stuff.
This is a bit of a thirsty book, even for a Star Wars book, even for a Star Trek book that I have paid money for. This is way too thirsty.
The novelization of an episode that's covering another episode. I mean, just what? Right, tell me, what's the question? Have you told me the question yet? I've lost track.
No, I haven't. So, again, 62. You want to keep that number in your head. 62 episodes of Clueless, because that's the only clue you're getting.
Yes.
Now, these 3 series... How many episodes did they run for combined? Now,
so just give me a reminder. So, Fast Times. Fast Times. Yeah. Next.
Baby Talk.
Baby Talk. And Clueless.
Clueless.
Right. So, the combined episode count of all those 3. So, 60 for Clueless, right? So, that gets us straight up there. I think Fast Times might have some potential. That's a fun movie. I can see that translating in the 80s to like a Full House. You know, that's the even the fact that it's just two words.
I'll give this to you if you're even remotely close.
Okay, within like five or something, yeah.
10, 20, I'll see what your guess is.
7,000. No, I think, right, so I'm going to say that Full House...
Can you imagine that Baby Talk series being even remotely worth a damn?
Well, this is, I'm going to say that had like the minimum viable. So in the 90s, maybe 2000s we're looking, I'm not sure, but I'm going to say that's probably around 10 to 13. I think Fast Times might have got a little bit more just because that was a really successful movie. It's kind of works for that format, the whole teenage stuff. I'm going to say 20. So what are we talking there? 60, 80. I'm going to say between 85 and 90.
You're close-ish, but probably not close enough for me to give it to you. The answer is 104.
Oh, I mean, come on.
So you're
on.
Pretty close, but like, you're not really with it. If you we'd been within 10, I'd be giving you it.
If I'd said 90 to 95, I think that would have
exactly.
been reasonable.
You'd have had it. Bing, bing, bing.
So that's a little...
Do you want to hear how many episodes each one got? Because this is
God
shocking.
Lord. Good.
Fast
Lord.
Times got 7 episodes, which is...
So I was completely wrong.
Which 7 episodes, which is heinous. Which is like... You know, that's... That's like you said, the advertisers are calling up and pulling out, and you are not allowed to show
what
coke in your
X?
Teenage series because it's actively going to decrease our market share.
Look at this. I'm just looking at the fucking Fast Times. The Baby Talk TV show.
Holy 35 episodes over 2 seasons.
Holy shit. Oh my God. This is... The Baby Talk features Baby Mickey, voiced by Tony Danza. What is happening? Season 1, season 2. We've got a full cast of characters. It had 23 episodes in its second season.
That's a big season.
Holy crap and a half. I'm just...
I don't know what it is about the Look Who's Talking that, like... It seemed that people wanted more of that. Like, that 35 episodes of a TV show kind of implies that people were kind of into that. They were like, they weren't sated with talking babies, with the film, or the sequel, or the shitty sequel to that.
Yeah. Yeah, and then Fast Times, the challenge Fast Times faces, says Jeff Borden of the Charlotte Observer, is emphasising the comedic elements from an R-rated film while soft-pedalling teen lust. That were major aspects of the movie. That's a very good point indeed. So yeah. There we go. Just shows you who knows what the fuck I'm talking about, because I clearly do not. But well done, Dave. You do, because you got all 3 points and you're today's winner.
And you did very well in that.
It's the end of the show.
It's tricky to do the quiz. It's tricky to do the quiz when we're reading the same trivia.
That's why it's a semi-relevant movie quiz, and that's why I spent a heck of a lot longer trying to get questions you could actually achieve get and not just guess at, Dave, but that's fine.
Do you know what happened? Do you
I'm
know what my mistake
bitter.
Was? Do you know what my mistake was? It was I had the question about Dan Hedaya because I think that's fascinating, because I'm a big Cheers fan.
I did like that.
I think it's
like
really
that.
Interesting. And I thought 13 episodes is perfect, because you guessed that and you did. Based on your own knowledge, like 13 is your perfect. That's when you're going to get cancelled in your first season. That's like they've given you enough rope to hang yourself, and that's it.
Just like Netflix.
And
now.
Then
yeah.
I made the mistake of looking at the director's Wikipedia page, and going down on the filmography and thinking, oh, she did Look Who's Talking and Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and like, oh, she's reasonably like successful and prolific. And then I saw like Baby Talk and Fast Times, and I was like, oh, are they adaptations of, and Clueless, and I was like, 3 of her films were adapted to TV shows.
This
Wild.
She clearly knows what she is doing and is able to deliver movies in a way and concepts in a way that you can't.
Yeah,
really...
She directed all sorts. I think she directed some episodes of The Office even. She works. So I thought it was interesting more than anything else. And then that just sort of spawned the questions of, well, he definitely won't know the answers. It's tricky to sort of peddle it to, you know, something you'll be able to guess without it being something you actually actively know.
Yeah, I think that is, that's the, it's always the trickiness of something like this, isn't it? But you know what, like, this is why I love doing these movies, because you just get to explore the whole Amy Heckerling cinematic universe. You know, like, who needs the Avengers? Who needs Iron Man? We can bring the cast of characters from teen movies across the spectrum, including loads of shitty
TV shows. Diane Keaton to voice a dog. Just to tie it all together.
Don't forget Danny DeVito as well. You know, like...
Again, I feel like that's just more in Dan DeVito's wheelhouse. He's quite happy to... We've seen him in Tottenham. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia has convinced me he will do anything.
Anything, yeah. And you don't have to leave the room. It's fine. Yeah, so well done, Amy Heckerling. You have done a fantastic job. And you deserve a hefty applause. And we'll see you next week.